Earlier today came the news that writer Sebastian Barry will receive the Bob Hughes Lifetime Achievement Award at the 2021 An Post Irish Book Awards, due to take place online next Tuesday. Since the 1980s, Barry has written 3 poetry collections, 15 plays and 10 novels, many of which are connected via characters called Dunn or McNulty, loosely inspired by the writer's own family history. He's also finishing his tenure as Laureate for Irish Fiction, and 3 lectures, The Lives of the Saints, will be published by Faber in 2022. Delighted to have Sebastian Barry join me now. That's quite a phrase, Sebastian, lifetime achievement.
I know. And it is. I was just counting up this supposed, well, the working life anyway, which is 44 years. That is quite a long time. But of course, as we all know, time looked back on has only the dimension of, I don't know, the downturn of a bird's wing. It doesn't have any. I'm still that 22-year-old boy in number 64 Leeson Street writing short stories, I think, somehow. And I always feel I am starting out. And every time you write a new book, of course, you are basically starting out again.
And is it still as frightening starting out now? I mean, you've had such huge successes down the years between poetry, theatre and novels. Is it still as frightening, that starting out point?
It is properly terrifying, and I think you should be. I mean, from many angles, not least the fact that there's a huge presumption in writing a book. I mean, why do you think you can do that? Which is always something that unnerves me as I begin. And then what solaces you or what calms you is the mysterious process that it is, and that you realize must be shared by most living human beings, where you can seemingly, if you're lucky and you're working well, create a reality just as potent, just as real, not only as dreams, as human dreams, but as human waking. And I still regard that as miraculous. Mm. And it does make you wonder what sort of creature we are, truly, you know.
And I guess there's an added component to that in your case when we talk about reality, in that, as I said in the introduction, so many of the stories, I mean, if we think of The Steward of Christendom, the play famously starring Donal McCann as Thomas Dunn, the last chief superintendent of the Dublin Metropolitan Police in 1922, a long, long way, with his son Willie at the heart of it in the trenches during the First World War, that being a novel. Your latest novel, more up to date then, you know, we think of Roseanne McNulty in The Secret Scripture, or more recently Days Without End and A Thousand Moons, which bring us into the late 19th century. The relationship between family history, family lore, and the stories that you tell, and reality. I know this is probably the basis of somebody's PhD thesis.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, what is it for you? Why did the history of your two family trees, if you like, why did that provide you with such fodder, do you think?
Well, I think somewhere between alarm at my own childhood, but also that capacity for love that you have as a child for your people. Somewhere between those two things, I think this began. In some ways, I think age 10, you can be a better artist, as Eliot said to Pound, il miglio fabbro, when you're young, because you have nothing to lose and nothing to gain. You're simply trying to keep your feet on the ground and see where you are and find a compass for yourself. And I have spent 44 years doing no more nor less than that. Mm. The fact that I still don't quite know where I am is not to be held against me. I mean, one is lost, but one knows one is lost. And that's the very starting point for writing, I think.
Half the battle. And your two grandfathers and the two branches of the family, in some ways, if you could give us a sense of the paternal grandfather, first of all, and the relationship you had with him as a young child.
Well, I didn't have my grandmothers because they had died. Mm. But I had these two men They were outside the field of battle, as it were, the central family field of battle, which would have been home life. They came in and out of it. They were a sort of university of self in a way. My one grandfather had been, he'd been a major in the British Army in bomb disposal during the war. He was an engineer. He was a rather, you know, he was an ill-fitting person, you might say, in Irish history in that way. But he fitted me like a glove. And my other grandfather had been a revolutionary in his youth in 1916 and was a painter. But these two men, for some reason, did what all grandfathers should do, which is spend time. They spent time with the strange young boy that I was. I was apprenticed to the painter grandfather for a year or two when I was 11 or 12. And my other grandfather, I was apprenticed to him in the sense that he exulted in stories. And I shared a bed with him as he told me these stories when I was small. So they became a sort of wizards and rescuers in my childhood, and franked my ticket for being a human being, I think. So I can only repay them by thinking about them every day and writing about them from time to time.
And if, you know, the easy presumption is to say, oh, you know, he's just delving into his family history and he's lucky enough to have great stories in his family history that he has to tell. But Willie, for example, just to give one example in a long, long way, you didn't have, well, if there were a Willie, he would have been your great-granduncle?
Great-uncle.
Your great-uncle, beg your pardon. He would have been your great-uncle. But in fact, you didn't have just one great uncle. He's an amalgam of characters, really, isn't he?
He is. Well, this is the whole point. I've been told so often that I write about my family and write family stories that I almost believe it myself. But of course, I'm deeply confused by those statements in a way, because and the fact that I actually sort of believe them now is a bit worrying to me. But actually, I haven't largely made them up. I mean, even when you think you know a story about somebody, you are in effect making it up, because they will disagree strongly with your version. But in the case of somebody like Willie Dunn, when I was writing The Steward of Christendom, the play, he more or less appeared in that play. He was dressed as a young boy in a First World War uniform. And instead of blood on his uniform, he had gold. I actually didn't know who he was at all. And that was Willie Dunn. And then I followed him to war then for a novel. I subsequently found out that my great grandfather did have three sons at the war, one of whom was a chaplain. Well, I think they came home, so I'm not absolutely certain.
Yeah.
I'm finding that person in the ether, and I'm following them faithfully as if they were real.
Yeah.
But I would say 80-90% of all this work of 44 years is invented. Thank God, because that's the writer's job.
Absolutely. And when we can talk about novels, and obviously the Lifetime Achievement Award isn't just about the novels, the body of theatre work that's in there as well. No. Steward of Christendom with Donald McCann. But I'm even going to go back further than that to Boss Grady's Boys, which is, I think, possibly the first big breakthrough play for you, with the wonderful Eamon Kelly and Jim Norton in that particular play. And the world of theatre was there for you, because of your mother, Joan O'Hara, was obviously a well-known actor.
It wasn't there for me because of that, because I tended to keep away from it.
For that very reason.
It was written when I was about 33. So I had kept away from the theatre somewhat. But I have loved my time in the theatre. I know you're a theatre man too, Sean. Mm. I mean, there is something so blessed about a good group of people in rehearsal working towards the same point. Yeah. And when that goes well, it is a blissful thing. You don't need to, you know, tone down the word or anything. And I've loved all that. And I've loved the, I mean, if my God, if I have gods as an agnostic person, they're all actors. I mean, Donal and Sinead Cusack and Claire Bloom and all the people I've worked with, and Niall Buggy most recently, and David Ganley in On Blueberry Hill, which is still, I just the crazy privilege of being with people like you, a lot of actors, is it has been the joy, one of the great joys of my life.
Yeah, and just talk to me a little bit about On Blueberry Hill, because it brings up another aspect of your writing, and it links in with some of the stuff you did as the Laureate of Fiction. This was a play set in a prison, and I think it did predate your tenure as the Laureate for Fiction, but you've expanded more on that interest in prison life and writing in prisons, I think, during your time as Laureate.
Yeah, because Jim Cullerton, my dear companion and comrade Jim Cullerton and I, we brought On Blueberry Hill into Mountjoy Prison where it's set. And we didn't know what we were expecting. We were told, you know, people might be a bit restless or not very interested, and that's fine, you know, a great bunch of men. But the attention paid to the play, it seemed to me to hark back to the very origins of theatre, where if you show something to someone that's important to them, they will give you a level of attention that is almost uncanny. And that made me feel that, we were not only moved by that, we were changed by it, Niall and David and Jim and myself. So I thought when I was made Laureate that one of the contributions I could possibly make was to take a note from that song and bring a sort of a book club into not only prisons and Central Mental Hospital, but also other hospital settings, people who are having dialysis, you know, which is just an awful entrapment of a person's time, you know, if you have to have your blood changed. So we did all that. And the idea was to go to people, readers, who couldn't come to me. But by the third year of the laureateship, that was the whole world.
So
we had to go online. But I mean, there were silver linings to that as well, because instead of being, you know, going to four or five Irish prisons, we were able to do, you know, 10 online all at one go. And to hear it, Sean, I mean, women in Limerick, whatever, reading the secret scripture, and to hear their messages back to me, not heartbreaking, but heart lifting.
Yeah.
No, really, real true magic for a writer. I mean, talk about a lifetime. These things, if you were making a film of my life, I mean, these would be the moments
you'd want to see. Let me come back to the novels then, and I suppose Days Without End in particular, which was in and around the time of the equal marriage referendum, the same sex marriage referendum at that time. And I know you spoke directly to your own son's experience in the fictionalized 19th century characters of Thomas McNulty and his partner John Cole. I'm calling it the follow-up, but in fact it's a totally different novel, Winona in a Thousand Moons. I suppose Winona, their child, the child that they end up looking after, a Native American woman, is she a totally invented person so that people can say, well, is she in his family as well?
Well, I take the outrageous liberty of claiming her. Thomas McNulty is invented, except I did have a great uncle at the Indian Wars, but I know nothing about him. Nothing is remembered. Like many an Irish person, no news of him ever came back to Sligo. So if in the making up of that book, which was one of the other excitements of my life in this very place where I'm sitting talking to you, if he's real to me, then his daughter, adopted daughter, is real to me, and I can claim her as an ancestor, but only along the sweet, forgiving, gentle lines of fiction. Yeah. You know,
you started out by saying talking about how the looking back is a very short process in some ways. Particularly when the Lifetime Achieve Award comes along, you might presume there'd be a looking back. So, if you're not looking back, then to finish up, Sebastian, what are you looking forward towards at this point in time?
Well, I'm hoping to emulate Edna O'Brien and only stop. Well, she hasn't stopped yet. So I think Edna must be 90 anyway. I think that's the way to go with it. I mean, if I'm 66, if I was a solicitor, I might be retiring. But, you know, there's no retiring for artists. The only person, writer I know who actually retired was V.S. Naipaul. Other than that, I don't know. Apart from the fact that you don't have any substantial pension to your name, you go on because you can't resist the excitement of it. And that's what I'm looking forward to. I've just finished a new book, which will be published in 2023. So March. So plenty of time to panic about that.
will we be in the family area again?
I seem to be. Yes, there is a connection, but I seem, like with A Thousand Moons, I seem to be just working out on the edge of the canvas, which is very interesting to me. I would like to say, Sean, about the Lifetime Achievement Award. You know, that's from the trade to which I belong, and I'm very proud to belong, you know, the book trade and the bookshops. And one of the things in the pandemic that became almost alarmingly clear is how utterly essential booksellers and bookshops are. You know, they're the little churches and temples of our trade. And, it, you know, they disseminate stories, which there couldn't be a nobler calling, especially if, as we're told, the very telling of a story beside a fire is the basis of this creature that we have been for 200,000 years. So I just want to say that it is a mark of, I don't know, it's a hand raised, a greeting from my own group of people whom I've worked with now for all these years, 44 years.
Well, I'm sure I would speak for a lot of people who would want to raise their hands in salutation to you this evening as well, and to congratulate you, Sebastian. So may I do that on mine and their behalf. Congratulations on the award, Sebastian, and thanks for speaking to us this evening.
Thank you, Seanine.
That's Sebastian Barry, and Sebastian's three lectures as Laureate, The Lives of the Saints, will be published by Faber in 2022. The Unpost Irish Book Awards 2021 will be streamed live on Tuesday, the 23rd of November. That's on rte.ie/culture or at the irishbookawards.ie. And there will be a one-hour special that will be broadcast on RTE1 television on Wednesday, the 8th of December. Set in an epic fantasy world, The Wheel of Time follows Moraine, played by Rosamund Pike, a member of an incredibly powerful all-female organisation called the Aes Sedai, as she arrives in the small town of Two Rivers. There she embarks on a dangerous, world-spanning journey with five young villagers, one of whom is prophesied to be the Dragon Reborn, the one who will either save or destroy humanity. Sound familiar? Well, in 2017, billionaire owner of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, wanted My Game of Thrones, as he called it. I don't know how much emphasis was on the my bit. He wanted his own epic fantasy series because he'd been watching Game of Thrones. And Aoife Barry is with me in studio this evening to tell us a little bit about The Wheel of Time, which is Jeff's own fantasy series.
Yeah.
Was it as simple as that, Aoife? That was the starting point. I want my Game of Thrones.
So the story goes, and I don't think it sounds like something that's made up when you hear that, because Jeff Bezos has so much money. He's a billionaire. He can do whatever he wants. He bought the Prime Video company, became Amazon Prime. He wants to make whatever he wants. And he's also a really big Lord of the Rings fan. So it's well known that he's a fantasy fan. He's named companies after elements to do with the fantasy world, like books and Star Wars and things like that. So he also wanted to get in on the money. Like, Game of Thrones was a phenomenon. I mean, so many people listening to this show now will have watched it. And you know, there's something to be made there. It did change TV in many ways, and it showed these big epic TV shows could be made. So why would Jeff Bezos not want to get onto that?
Well, we'll come to the Game of Thrones comparisons a bit further on. Let's give, to be fair, The Wheel of Time its own moment in the sun, as it were, before we start comparing. We are talking about a series of books that were for young adults initially, yeah?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about it is there's about 14 different volumes and a prequel to these books. So they were written by Robert Jordan. He started writing the first one. It took him 6 years. He published the first one in 1990, and it just became a really big phenomenon. And most of the, about half the books, if not more, were bestseller books. They were aimed, I suppose, at young adults. The main characters in it were young adults. They've been changed to become, well, I suppose, more teenagers. They're now older, at like young adults in the TV series. And it just really captured people. I mean, if you're somebody who's into the fantasy genre, you will love these world building building books where you get so much detail on the characters, on the world, where you just, Robert Jordan gets to create this entire world, this way of thinking, all of this lore. And anybody I know who's a fan of these books loves that you get all of that. And he spends a lot of time apparently on describing things. So you get a lot of description. Yeah. And it's hard to bring all that into a TV show. It really is.
Well, let's try to get the essence of what's involved here. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the Wheel of Time without me and everybody else nodding off?
Okay, yeah, this is tough, right? Because I did find this tough about the show. The hardest part was the plot. So I'm just going to break it down in really basic terms. So the wheel in the Wheel of Time is a great wheel that turns, and history turns with the wheel. And when the wheel has finished its rotation, the people who died in that turn kind of return in new forms. So they can
be
reborn.
It's not just history repeating itself, it's kind of the people repeat themselves.
Exactly.
Maybe having learned a lesson, maybe not.
Exactly. And so alongside that, thousands of years ago, magic, which exists in this world, was corrupted. And basically it meant that any man who tries to use this magic goes mad. But that doesn't happen to women. And that led to a group of women called the Aes Sedai being formed. And they're this group of women with magical powers and who also become very powerful, kind of politically powerful. They're not all, you know, good people, but they are, so they're the magic people there. And so basically, along with this, along with kind of the idea of the wheel turning, is this idea of the dragon being reborn on each turn. And this person, the dragon who's reborn as a certain, like a man or woman, has the power to kind of, you know, change the world or, you know, kind of do good or bad things. And so you get Moraine, who is an Aes Sedai, one of these women who's searching for the dragon reborn in this particular turn of the wheel. She figures out that it's one of these teenagers who lives in this little village called the Two Rivers, and she goes and finds him. And then they go on a quest, which is one of the many fantasy tropes in the series.
That's the world of fantasy literature and fantasy stories, really, isn't it? But the really interesting shift, or one of the very interesting shifts here immediately, is the gender politics.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, like, this is obviously going to be compared a lot to Game of Thrones, and Game of Thrones is known as kind of the swords and porn show in that it doesn't really have very good gender politics in it. It's got a lot of nudity, which is generally of the women. This show is really interesting because the women hold the power in terms of the magic, but you do get more of a sense of, like, the female gaze in this. You don't have moments where, I think in Game of Thrones you would have had nudity. You actually have women covered up, or you have a man appearing naked in some sense.
Yeah, I saw a part of episode one and there was some nudity in it, but it was a man.
Yeah, exactly. And in a kind of a gratuitous shot that you really would have had a woman in Game of Thrones. And in this, so you have the power there, you have the relationships, and they spend a lot of time in the first episode of setting up this Two Rivers situation, this particular town where all these people live. And in that particular town, you really get a sense of the women as being business owners, of being community leaders. It was really interesting how many of them were present in this alehouse having fun and not actually just serving people or being girlfriends or whatever, you know. So I did really appreciate that. And the showrunner, Rafe Judkins, who is a young guy who's worked on other shows before, who pitched this to Amazon, he really put this forward. He was like, I can give you this more diverse, gender balanced world, pulling from the book, which did bring you these women characters, but giving you more of a 2021 version of it. Because, you know, from what I heard, Robert Jordan maybe didn't write, like, the greatest women characters, and now you kind of get a stronger sense of them in this.
That aspect has been amplified in the television series from the books.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen to a clip. We can't get into who all five of the villagers are because I think we could get bogged down in that. But
Definitely. This
is Rosamund Pike as Moraine, who is the character going around the place looking for the dragon reborn. That's what she's doing here. And she's explaining to the others in this scene, she's explaining why she has come to Two Rivers, the town, and why she is looking for dragon reborn. And we'll hear Barney Harris as Matt, Madeline Madden as Egwene, Marcus Rutherford as Perrin, Daniel Henney as Lan, and Joshua Stradovsky as Rand, all in the middle of this scene as well.
20 years ago, there was a woman at the White Tower. An Aes Sedai born with eyes so white she couldn't see anything. Yet still she saw glimpses of the turning of the wheel. The Dark One is waking. His whispers are already in the backs of our minds. But there will be one who can stand against him. The dragon has been born again. And it's one of you.
You fully lost your mind.
Moraine.
What are those?
The Dark One's army. More Trollocs.
300 at least. Out there. they get here so fast?
Get the horses.
Well, you can't leave.
You're coming with me. The four of you. Your life isn't going to be what you thought. You've lived too long in these mountains, pretending that what happens in the rest of the world won't affect you.
We can't just leave.
They're after you. They will follow you. And if you stay here, this is where they'll come. They will leave nothing and no one standing, and I can't do anything to stop them. Our only chance is to reach the White Tower and the other sisters of the Aes Sedai. There's no time. We leave now.
That's Rosamund Pike et al. In that scene from Wheel of Time, the new, I believe they're calling it Prime Video again as opposed to Amazon Prime.
I think they've
dropped the Amazon bit. They're just referring to it as Prime. At any rate, there we had, in the midst of that clip, Aoife Barry, who's speaking to us about the series this evening, the White Tower, the Dark One is waking, we have to leave now and go to the White Tower. I mean, that could be anything from, you know, just change the word slightly and you're in Lord of the Rings, you're in Game of the Thrones, you're in every fantasy series that there's ever been. Is this different in any way?
Well, I think what's interesting about this one is because it was published in 1990, it was a really important one of its time. So it's, I suppose we can't really look at it as something that's bringing something new to the table. Like the TV series is trying to bring something new around it, but this series brought something new at the time in the 90s to people, and it did pull from the Lord of the Rings. Robert Jordan was influenced, like his publishers did want him to be influenced by Tolkien, and you do see a lot of that coming through. But the idea of the high fantasy world, it has these tropes, and that, and the word tropes isn't meant in a negative way in that sense. It does have the quest, it has, you know, like in Lord of the Rings, you have the One Ring, you always have some sort of a Dark Lord, and you have these worlds that are built that do have similarities. And so I think if you're going into this expecting none of that to be there, you wouldn't be getting a fantasy show. So what you do get is the differences in this to the other series, you know, so you have to pick out the individual differences. And I think it does bring you some really interesting elements, and that gender element and the magic element are particularly interesting in it.
And the big fuss made about the absence or the lack of CGI in it. How real looking is it? How does it look? And are you going to be watching the rest of it?
Yeah, some of it looks quite real, some of it doesn't. I wasn't that impressed with they spend about 10 million per episode on it, right? But I thought their wardrobe literally looked like things had been made in a factory, which is not what you want to see. You want to see handmade clothes in this. The CGI as well, at moments it was great, at other times you felt like this was a hand, you know, it was a constructed village that nobody had ever lived in. I do want to finish off the series. I saw the 6 episodes out of the 8, so I am interested to see where it goes, because I thought there weren't a lot of set pieces in it. I wanted a bit more of that, and I want to see if it really wants me kind of hungry for the series too. They are going to make a second series that's already been commissioned because they have all the money in the world, so we'll see how that goes.
All right, so you're going to stick with it and see what comes of it. That's Aoife Barry speaking to us about The Wheel of Time, available now on Amazon Prime Video or Prime Video, I believe. And Friday night means album night. 3 major albums up for review this week. 30 from Adele, Damon Albarn's solo album, The Nearer the Fountain, More Pure the Stream Flows, and Elbow's new release, Flying Dream One. Nadine O'Regan and Brian Boyd have been listening. They're with me now. We start with Adele, singer-songwriter who brought us albums 19, 21, 25. Now she's back with 30, all referring to her age, obviously. But also in the case of 30, we're talking about a post-divorce record. Let's start with a track. It's Adele. It's post-divorce. Cry Your Heart Out is the title of the track.
Cry your heart out. It'll clean your face. When you're in doubt, go at your own pace.
Feel like me again, I'm hanging by a thread. My skin
Your Heart Out. I'd love that track from Adele and the new album 30. Nadine O'Regan and Brian Boyd, as I said, our reviewers on this Friday evening. Much anticipated. It's always there with albums and films, particularly, I think, Nadine. But on a quite definitely, in the case of Adele, this was a much anticipated album. Oh.
Yeah. For Adele, I mean, it's a record where she has to fight off her own history as much as anything else, because she has been so incredibly successful. She's sold over 120 million albums worldwide, and she's one of the few artists that you know by their first name.
Exactly, and only by the first name, which is a big statement in and of itself. Heartbreak is her modus operandi, really, Brian, isn't it?
Absolutely, but it's almost become Mac Adele now. You saw on the last 1921, great albums. On 25, she was treading water, and she was too much into that sort of sound. Everyone predicted and knew that sound, which was minor piano chords, and then her sighing about love, regret, hurt, sorrow, and pain. I say Mac Adele because it was like 100 million heartbroken listeners served each album, and she. On this album, you have to remember that this is she's one of those artists where record company jobs depend on the performance of this album. Adele sells over 20 million per album. That the pressure she's under is massive, and the pressure for this to perform commercially means jobs are on the line. So what we get here is we get 70% Mac Adele, that traditional, those minor piano chords, those songs of, oh, I'm in love, but I'm not in love. And only towards the end of the album, she actually flexes some musical muscles and gives us something new. And that's the part of the album I loved.
Yeah, that album of two halves, again, a well-worn cliche. But particularly in the case of this album, in the second half, like the song we just heard, Cry Your Heart Out, it's a wonderful upbeat track. And yet she is singing about heartbreak.
Yeah, she's singing about heartbreak, and she's doing it in a production style that in some ways is very classic and timeless. You know, the comparisons you'd evoke would be Ella Fitzgerald, and actually you do think about Amy Winehouse, how she brought those touches of Motown into the sound. And to some extent, you can feel that she wants to achieve timelessness. You know, this is a record that wants to be in the here and now, but also wants to be played decades from now. That feel is very strong throughout the album, that the production is very, very thought through, but at the same time, it's intentionally minimalist in the sense that it puts all of the emphasis on Adele's vocal, so that no matter how much wizardry is going on in the background in terms of digital tweaks or anything else, Adele's strident, strong, dominant vocal carries throughout these tracks. She is brutally honest. I mean, the conversations with her 9-year-old son describing how, you know, that she still loves him and talking about how she's experiencing anxiety and confusion, and some of the words come from voice notes and others come from voicemails that she left for friends. And there's the sound of her crying. I mean, there's actually the sound of her sniffing into the microphone. It's the first time I've actually heard that on a record.
Yeah, let's have a little listen to a little bit of the song that you're talking about there, which is, as you say, her 9-year-old son Angelo James is part of this particular track as well. It's a track called My Little Love.
Your eyes wide and like an ocean when you look at me, so full of my emotions. I'm finding it hard to be here sincerely. I know you feel lost, it's my fault completely. Recognize myself in the coldness of the daylight, so I ain't surprised you can read through all of my lies. I feel so bad to be here when I'm so guilty. I'm so far gone and you're the only one who can save me.
Why do you feel like that?
You don't like me.
You know Mummy doesn't like anyone else like I like you, right? I'm
holding on. All right, that's a little taste of My Little Love. And the exchanges there, Brian, the command, tell me you love me. I kind of felt that she was saying to the little boy, and then you're the only one that can make Mummy feel better. They're kind of all right. But as that song goes on, she starts basically a kind of a confessional mode. Some of it to the son, some of it, as Nadine pointed out, on voice notes and the like. You know, there's confessional and then there's
creepy.
Was that how you found it?
Yeah, and you know, she's the first one to complain about press intrusion into her family life. Don't use a 9-year-old child to sell albums, Adele. Please don't do it. It's and apart from that bit, there's also a lot of this Californian self-help psychobabble on it, and it's really not doing her any favours at all. And she's in danger of, it's almost like listening, it's almost like Princess Diana's Last Few Days, the way, you know, she brings that emotion up to the very forefront. And it's I found it emotionally manipulative.
What about you, particularly in that? And it's there more so there in the songs in the first half of the album, I would hazard to say, Nadine. Did you feel that type of manipulation? And yet I'm guessing there are people who are Adele fans who want that. They will say, but she's been honest about how she feels and what she's going through.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very difficult tightrope that she's walking, because vulnerability is very important in art, and actually being brave enough to put yourself out there and potentially fail. That's a hard, hard task. And it's something that most great artists try to do in one way or another. And all artists probably should try and do. But there is a line. And I suppose I found myself listening to the track and immediately feeling tremendously sympathetic towards Adele and thinking about her life. And suddenly, almost by virtue of her reducing herself in this way over the course of the track, I found myself thinking, gosh, she's so relatable. She's just like everyone else, despite the millions and the album sales and all that. And then as the track wore on, I did find myself thinking, hang on, am I being manipulated here to think a certain way? And it's possible for both things to be true, you know, for her to feel that putting out that vulnerability is the right move for her, and for the listener to feel a little bit manipulated.
Stars from you, Adele. That's just the third time I've gone to. I've finally done it. I finally called you, Adele. Stars from you, Nadine. Maybe you have to sing the stars now. Four stars. Four. So it is. It's a very positive four from you.
I mean, look, just to say, at the end of the day, she is a tremendous talent, and there are tremendous producers on this. Greg Kurstin has done her proud. So, you know, regardless of some of the missteps, there are some great successes within the various tracks.
Briefly, your stars, Brian?
It's when she gets out of her own head and sings and does songs like All Night Parking, which is a beautiful 1930s piano bar vibe to it. I didn't like the Macadell material at the beginning. Three stars.
Three stars for Brian. Okay, let's move on then. That's for Adele's new album, 30. Let's move on to album number two. Long title, The Nearer the Fountain, More Pure the Stream Flows. Heady Days of Blur and Britpop. Damon Albarn has worked on all kinds of collaborative projects, from Afrobeat to opera and his own cartoon band, Gorillaz. The Nearer the Fountain, More Pure the Stream Flows is the title of his new album. Something of a rarity, a Damon Albarn solo album, his second, in fact. Let's have a listen to the title track.
Help me.
Bit there of the opening and title track from The Nearer the Fountain, More Pure the Stream Flows, a solo album from Damon Albarn. Nadine, a very contemplative mood here, I think, from Albarn. Very introspective. Made in Iceland was this album. Is that playing a big role in the way he's looking inward, I suppose, in terms of what he's doing on this album?
Yeah, I think for sure. He had said actually, Abbott, you know, that he'd been on his own dark journey. And this is very much a COVID album, and the kind of COVID album where one's thoughts do turn inwards. And there's a contemplation here and an experimentalism that you can really hear on that particular track and throughout the record. Actually, one of the things that's very interesting about it is the extent to which chance appears to play a part on the record, because unlike the Adele album, Damon Albarn seems to be wandering, even within various songs, wherever his fingers take him, in terms of whether on the keyboards or wherever else. The song structures are curious. You know, they have unusual beginnings and ends. They trail off or they move into something else completely different. So it's actually quite interesting as a sort of an experimental listen, and it reminds me of people like, say, Trent Reznor on some of his soundtracks, or Cliff Martinez and Johan Johansson. You know, it has nothing in common with a typical Blur record or Gorillaz. There's nothing pop about this. But if you like any of those artists, then you would find this appealing.
Yeah. Would you concur with the musically experimental nature of this album, Brian, before we get into what he's actually talking about and why that might be bothering you?
No, the songs didn't work for me at all. It's Damon with a very sort of sad, mournful voice going on about, oh my God, the rivers and the lakes, and I'm so sad about the environment. And musically, you get these bossa nova rhythms coming in a very incongruous manner, almost like they're played on a Casio keyboard. And then you just get these saxophone solos coming in for no reason whatsoever. There's no empathy at all between the lyrics and the music. The songs don't work.
And what the climate change aspect of it, I think, the fact that he's singing about all that annoyed you enormously.
Not enormously, but he's a celebrity multimillionaire who spent lockdown flying between his three homes. And the whole point of this album is he's talking about the effects of climate change on the view he has from his one of his mansions in Iceland, in Reykjavik, a place he flies to frequently from London. And I just feel that it's him looking out of this beautiful view of glaciers and mountains going, oh dear, climate change, it's really sad. I'm going to write an album about it. It's gross hypocrisy, Sean.
Did that aspect of the album bother you, Nadine?
No. I enjoyed the elements of nature that you could hear. You know, there's the sound of water and the track Ezra. There's almost like a bee-like buzzing on Royal Morning Blue. And yes, he does sing Stay By My Side at the end of the world. And he does sound resigned and melancholic. And there are like ripples of piano. There's some spacey synths. But, you know, I found myself quite getting into it. Like, I wouldn't say that it's an album for everybody by any manner of means. I think it is highly experimental, but taking it as it seems to be offering itself, which is that Damon Albarn very much knows that. And actually he said, I mean, he's coming to the NCH in February, and he said that before they rescheduled the dates, he had planned to simply do orchestral swathes of music at that, and he wasn't even going to sing. So this is where he's at with this record. And look, is it indulgent? I mean, of course it is, but he's also a multimillionaire musician who's definitely earned the right to have a little indulgence if he wants.
Certainly has the money to have a little indulgence. Stars from you, Nadine?
Three
from you. And what are you saying, Brian?
Singing about climate change while you're causing climate change. One and a half
from Brian. Let us move on then to our final album this evening, Manchester Stalwarts. Elbow returned with ninth album, Flying Dream One, written and arranged with the band remote from one another, recorded in Brighton's Theatre Royal post-lockdown. The work sees them in soothing contemplative mood, with Guy Garvey's distinctive and beautiful vocal still central to everything as it is on this track.
hide February shadows. And I can hear a school, a woman humming to the radio. They never didn't improve the tune. Saddleworth, DNA of those dark and bitter days. Knowing that it came my way to Tanya in corduroy and marigolds. Baby lamb, did you steal some matches? Guilty.
A little bit there of Calm and Happy, one of the tracks on Elbow's new album. I love, Brian, I was saying as we were listening there, I love the little almost, it is not almost, it's spoken word at the very top before he goes off into that wonderful singing voice of his. How would you, what do you think Elbow and Guy Garvey have achieved to date?
Oh, an awful lot. They came in from the margins. They had, I mean, Asleep in the Back was their first album way back, I think about 2000. But everyone knows them because the Seldom Seen Kid album in 2008, which still their best known two songs are One Day Like This and Grounds for Divorce. Mm. And they did become an arena band off of that. But they've kept very much, they're very much artistic integrity. And this album is very, very different. Again, lockdown album. But they went into this album with a shopping list of great albums, which were John Martin's Solidaire, Van Morrison's Astral Weeks and the Blue Nile's Hats, and they wanted to record a complete album, no real singles as such, a mood album, and it's all very subdued, it's all very quiet. And you heard Guy's mellow tenor there, yeah. That just seeps in, and the lyrics are so, they're poetic.
Yeah, and in terms of this album, Brian, give us a sense of what has made them such a success to date, Nadine. Are those elements present? It's unmistakably an Elbow album. The minute you turn it on, you wouldn't even have to see a track listing or a title on the front of it. You'd know it was Elbow. What makes it so immediately recognisable as such?
Oh, you know, the intention to soothe, you know, if Damon wants to reflect the sadness of climate change or the pandemic, Guy Garvey wants to tell you everything is going to be OK. and he does, you know, over the course of 10 tracks. For me, the only issue with this is that a slight sameness creeps in and Elbow, like for me, a track like, say, Grounds for Divorce is one of my favourite tracks from them, precisely because it feels so different from much of their other material. Whereas this, to some extent, is variations on what is ultimately a good song, and they're playing it in different ways, but the mood remains a little bit mono, and I would have liked to have seen them expand their palette a little bit in that respect.
Okay, well, let's have a little listen to the title track, Flying Dream One.
Flying Dream One, dead of the night when the prayer group was gone. My sisters all blissful at feather. Candle wicks swaddled my golden wee brother. Dad's across town tonight fixing the mirror. Shaking his head at a richer man's grammar. Swerving the creek as I slide to the stairs.
Just a little taste there of Flying Dream One, title track from the new Elbow album. Do you feel all soothed and in a good place after listening to Guy Garvey and Elbow, Brian?
That song is his Penny Lane Strawberry Fields. If you listen to the lyrics, and I've advised people to read these lyrics, we were just saying he's a good friend of Simon Armitage, he's the poet.
The poet, yeah.
And I think Guy Garvey is the visiting professor of poetry at Salford Junior. I could be wrong on that, but I know he is very interested in poetry.
Sensibility in there.
And you get this, that track was beautiful, all about his youth, and you get wonderful imagery. But what I really liked here was you get woodwind, and you get these very subdued string sections, and you get these brushed up, which really match with the lyrics.
Stars, Brian.
Four for me.
And what are you saying, Nadine?
Love the lyrics also, but a tiny bit samey, so 3 stars.
3 stars from you. That's Elbow Flying Dream 1, Damon Albarn, The Nearer the Fountain, More Pure the Stream Flows, and Adele 30, the albums that Nadine and Brian were speaking to us about this evening. Incidentally, Nadine, will you be playing? I know you're on Rising Time. You'll be going straight to bed after this. You're on Rising Time tomorrow morning. Will you be playing any of the three aforementioned? Adele might get a spin, would she? Or have you decided?
Adele, and I think Come On Blue from the Elbow album is just a gorgeous track. So, yeah, something we'll get a spin for sure.
All right. Well, I don't know if I'll be up to hear you at that point in time. But for those who are, you're in for a treat to hear those tracks and indeed to hear Nadine's other choices as well.